Welcome back for another helping of Oysters, Clams, and Cockles, where every week we discuss the best shows and movies so you know what to watch and have plenty of takes to dish out at dinner parties in 2023 post-pandemic. I'm Ross Bolin, here with your co-host Barrett Dudley. And Barrett, it may have been 2 weeks ago, but today we're finally talking about the finale of HBO's The White Lotus.
Yeah, 3 weeks ago. I mean, it's been 3 weeks since we've been on a regularly scheduled pod. That's okay, because I took the time off and I just got out there and I did what nobody else would do. They were refusing to do it, and I just watched all of TV. Every season I just watched it.
So you're all caught up on everything.
You could call me an ocean explorer, if you will. That's a little reference that maybe some of you get, and I'll talk about later.
Sure.
But my ocean here is TV, and I'll prove that I've watched everything. Name a show.
Solo. What's the one where he climbs?
Free Solo.
Free Solo.
I give it a B+.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Name another one.
I Love Lucy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A minus.
A minus.
It's sort of aged, you know, it was great 15 years ago, you know, 20 years ago when I was watching it on Nick at Night.
Yeah.
When I caught up this time around, sure. I was like, I'm bumping it, from A+ to A-.
Okay, the second season of that dumbass show on Netflix about the beach kids.
Outer Banks.
Yeah.
B-.
Okay.
Still enjoyable schlock, but, you know, it's like I wasn't. So anyway, there's your proof that I've watched every single thing on television over the last 3 weeks. I've seen it all. So lots to talk about today. But I am excited, like you said, up top to give the people what they want, which is slightly stale, lukewarm, 3 week old White Lotus takes.
Exactly. Yes. That's why I'm wearing this ridiculous Ted Baker Hawaiian and a Rolex and Felix Gray shades and a hat that says degenerate on it. And I pump myself full of ketamine.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
While everyone else was hastily rushing out their White Lotus takes, Barrett and I were letting the show marinate.
Ample time to digest.
Exactly. We gave it the time it deserved.
Sue us.
We wanted it to breathe so we could truly taste the deep roots of the vineyard and come correct with the best takes possible. You're welcome.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Here we are. So, all said and done.
Yeah.
Who was in the box? Our boy Armin.
Yeah, gas me up, because that's what I said.
Yeah.
From week one, I think, maybe week two. Now, I do want to toot my own horn here, but I will also, I hedged as well, because I was 50-50, right? I was like, my lead option was actually that I thought it was a head fake. And that it wasn't going to be somebody that we knew in the box, that it was going to be a total kind of red herring, if you will. But my take, if it was one of our characters, was Armand from early on. I did feel pretty proud of myself there.
Especially as that scene unfolds with Armand in the you know, he takes the shit in the guy's suitcase, which is one of the funniest moments in the whole show. And then I was like, oh wow, are they gonna have this happen right here? Because when he comes in and it becomes clear he's not gonna leave the condo or the hotel suite, you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, but at first I was
They've already set you up with the knife over on the table. By the way, the whole thing, you know, there's been some debate and some argument about, or really just some conversation, some discourse, if you will, around, you know, like, is it kind of cheating to show us the box at the very beginning of the episode one?
Sure.
Right? And I don't really think it is, because what it does is it keeps around people that otherwise might not just be interested in the, like, oh, let's dissect some white privilege and some upstairs downstairs stuff, like in a vacation resort in Hawaii, right? So it really rounds it out. And then
it gives it another layer.
Yeah, and then in the final episode, man, if you weren't on the edge of your seat for essentially every single scene, because you were like, oh, here it is. Here it is. Armand is going to kill Rachel right at the dinner table.
Yep.
Because he's such a loose cannon. Now he's going to freak out. He's done. He's getting fired. He's going to stick it to Shane. He's going to kill his wife.
Yeah.
Like, or like the, you know, the men on the scuba trip, like, something terrible is going to happen. Here it is. That
Somebody's
tank is going to explode.
That thing happen where they go up too fast and one of their lungs.
Yeah, they're
going
to get the bends.
The bends.
Yeah, so
gotta
it was
avoid
like,
the bends. Got to hit the books.
Got to hit the books. That's what, like, in that final episode, that's what it was really doing, is like keeping you very, very glued.
the tension.
You know, the tension was ramped up because we had this sense that it was probably going to happen. And like 40 minutes through that episode, I was like convinced. I was like, okay, the fact that no one has died yet, the fact that they keep playing with it so clearly, you know, you think, oh, Shane, he's got that knife to cut the pineapples, and now Rachel's breaking up with him, and he's standing there holding that knife.
Like, he's going to freak out.
There were so many times.
Everybody has reason to freak out.
Yes. So I was like, okay, it's not going to happen. I felt confident in, like, the fact that there's going to be some rando in the box. But then, yeah, they did. They gave it to us.
My suspicion was even, like,
Shane with the knife in the pineapple suite.
With Quinn, even. I was like, yeah. With the little brother, I was like, oh, this kid's going to freak
paddling out.
Paddling out
on the boat.
Kill one of his family members or himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought something like that might happen. They really did a good job in the end of playing with that, the original box question,
yes,
of who's going
to
be in there.
Right, and that's fun to get both, like, a show that's making you think on various levels about,
right,
you know, class and race and all that, and what it is to, like, try to leave yourself on vacation.
Yeah.
And
at whose
expense? Or in any type of, like, escapist
pleasure-seeking. Goes beyond just the resort and the people working there. It's also about, like, your family, at the expense of your family, at the expense of Quinn, at the expense, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of layers to it.
And then you also had this kind of, like, fun, like, what's going to happen? So it's just the fact that they give you both was I thought, really well done, and I enjoyed the finale.
Yeah, it was good. So Armand obviously ends up going full-blown off the rails, fuck it mode, and just blowing up his whole life to the point that he literally goes poos in a man's suitcase and then is stabbed to death by accident.
Yeah. Ross, I'm really glad that didn't happen to me when I pooped on that desk that one time.
Also glad that didn't happen to you, Barrett.
You know, some guy in that motorcycle store just creeping around with his knife that he had. He was cutting pineapples in the back.
Right. Would have been it for you.
I could have got.
That would have been it for you. Barrett one time did poop on a table. But yeah, so Armand gets the knife. Tanya tells Belinda, the masseuse, that she's not going to go into business with her, right? And that she's basically like, she kind of owns up to her shit, honestly. She's like, look, I tend to get swept up in things and distracted with blah, blah, blah. I mean, owns up to her shit, but also doesn't own up to her
but
shit
also
in any way
at all. Yeah, yeah.
By going and continuing to live the same exact life.
Yeah, there was certainly some irony there with telling Belinda that she didn't want to have a transactional relationship, and then falling into the arms of a guy who is essentially telling her that this is for sex and for fun. Right? It's like, so there is a transactional nature to their relationship anyway. There's a transactional relationship to most human.
Yes.
A transactional aspect to most human relationships. So the fact that, like,
all of them,
she
man.
Says that and then kind of, like, buys her guilt away.
Right.
You know?
By giving her money.
By giving her a stack of cash is, like, is very just, well, okay, fine. You whatever excuse you need to tell yourself, but
you're still kind of a piece.
All kind of bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah, you're still kind of a piece. Nicole and what's his name? Shane?
Rachel and Shane.
Oh,
and,
Rachel and Shane. Nicole's husband is?
Mike? Alex? No, not Alex.
Mark. Mark Mosbacher. The Mosbachers. What ends up happening with them?
Their relationship probably mends the most out of anybody's after he tackles Kai and kind of saves the day a little bit there.
Yeah, but it kind of shows how bullshit it is, right? Because it's like, did he really save the day? Was this guy really going to hurt her? I mean, okay, yes, we don't know what would have happened, but he basically tackled him, and then the guy beat his ass and ran off, right?
Like, yeah, yeah.
So he didn't really do all that much, and that's all it took to, like, reignite this, give some spark to his marriage, right?
Yeah,
I get that
yeah.
part. But in the end, the Mosbachers are basically able to completely write off any responsibility that they think they should have or that they would have in any of this situation, right? Basically, in society as a whole, they're just like, look, we're, like, for the right thing or whatever, but also, like, things don't change overnight, and, like, let's be reasonable about this, and also, like, let us just make millions of dollars and go on vacation, and, like, it's just kind of, they were, like, the classic American family, upper middle class, upper class
yeah,
American
I,
family.
Look, I really didn't think that Mike White, who created, directed, wrote this whole show, by the way, quick aside, I don't know if you read this, but this was essentially first draft all the way through. This was such a sped up process, and that, you know, they had called Mike White, been like, do you have anything for us? It needs to be COVID friendly. It needs to be quick. he was like, I'm not ready right this second, but I've always had this hotel idea. That he basically wrote it. They went to Hawaii. They shot for 6 or 8 weeks, and it was done. But there were no studio notes. No execs got in the way. There were no rewrites. There was no nothing. So
that's interesting.
So anything that you could kind of we could nitpick some like plot holes or some things that didn't really make sense or some things that maybe didn't quite work. But the fact that it did all work so well, like both of those things are kind of, well, it explains it. It's also incredible because this was basically a first draft script with no notes, no rewrites, and no like no multiple cooks in the kitchen, essentially.
Right, right.
Like
a pure message.
Yeah, it was in its most pure form, which is also why there were some things that maybe felt like hiccups here and there. Anyway, I really don't think that Mike White was saying the Mossbachers are bad. I don't think he was saying that Paula is good. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was all just I really felt like I was just like looking into the two different
positions
of the globe.
Yeah.
Right. And seeing kind of pitfalls of each, if you will.
Sure. Yeah. The different perspectives and the different angles and like sort of, I mean, that's kind of what all of us in America, especially the last 2 years who have been paying attention anyway, have had to do, right?
And
the self-analysis of like your place in it all.
And at the end of the day, like I think the maybe the biggest point that was made was that the only people that were hurt were from the downstairs, right? It was the lower class that were the victims of all of this, right?
It was at their expense.
Kai his life is
fucked now.
Is fucked now. Belinda doesn't get the opportunity to start the business. Armand ends up dead, right? So it's only the quote unquote little people.
Who knows where that pregnant lady is?
That like suffered here,
yeah.
Right? And so I think that is that was very clearly a point, but not necessarily that like the Mossbachers are evil because
or the
of
bad
that.
Guys on the show. No,
yeah,
no, no.
It's just the system is working. Like it's critical of the system more so than it is the Mossbachers. In particular.
Yeah.
And whether or not like they like because it felt like, you know, like the, like you said, like they write off their own kind of
involvement
in it by saying some of those things that we say, like, well, we can't change it overnight. Like
nobody
right,
surrenders their position in society.
But I also thought that was kind of a poignant and interesting point that like the whole thing about tribes and that nobody does surrender their privilege. Because then we see Paula, who has to cling on to her position more than anybody, right? Because she is upstairs right now. And she could have gone downstairs. She could have owned up to her part in the Kai situation, right? She could have stuck her neck out for him.
Right. And she chose not to.
But she chose not to. So that was her saying, well, I have a little piece of this pie right now.
And I'm
not willing to sacrifice it to do the right thing either.
Right.
And so it's like it you know, it just it's just
it was an interesting nuanced look at all
thing.
That.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
No, that was what made the show fun. It was a different kind of conversation around the social injustices of our society, right?
Yeah,
in a vacation setting that had a lot of attractive and funny people,
yeah.
and a bit of mystery to it with who's going to be in the box, and very outlandish characters like Armand and Dylan and whoever that third guy is they brought in for the orgy in this final episode.
What did you think of arguably like our most like likable character, Rachel?
Staying.
Going back to Shane in the very end.
I loved it because I thought it was realistic.
Yeah,
I think oftentimes, especially when you're younger, there's like this idealism that you're not willing to sacrifice for yet. There's this version of yourself that you know is maybe probably better or more on par with what you want for your life as like a person. With her, it's that she wants to be contributing in some way, but also the way she's found to contribute so far is kind of a joke. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So she's
yeah,
she's saying fuck it.
And she's writing listicles about boss bitches.
Yeah. She's a shitty clickbait yeah. artist. So,
yeah.
In the end, she picks the
girl bosses.
I guess the better life right now is what she picks.
Yeah.
And she's not yet willing again. She's not willing to sacrifice the things that she has gained through her relationship with Shane, to regain the things that she's losing yet. I don't think it bodes well for their marriage. I'll put it that way. I definitely see the point, and it was. I liked that they had her stay because it was an interesting flip, and I thought
it was
especially because we've seen him in the airport by himself.
Yes, she goes and gets her own room. It seems like it's all done.
Over.
It's over.
Then she comes in the airport.
And then she comes to the airport and
they hug it out, bitch.
Yeah.
So. In the end, I really liked what they did with her and Shane. I thought both of those characters were really cool and fun, you know, as a white person. And then Quinn was the shocker of the season.
What do you mean by cool? I know you don't actually mean they were
probably,
cool and fun.
Probably more hateable for people who didn't grow up around people like that. Like, I know a lot of people who fall into these categories, especially like younger couples who struggle with identity and have a lot of money. So
it's
more of a thing I can relate to than something that just makes me want to stab everyone. Right?
Yeah, I gotcha. Shane was very obviously the worst, but
somehow endearing.
But I wouldn't go so
on some level for me.
Relatable is more what I would say, because as I talked about in the earlier weeks of the show, it's like I totally understood and kind of like hated myself as well for knowing that I would bitch about the room as well.
Yeah.
And like probably not really be able to let it go. The fact that I didn't get the room that I had paid for, and that the guy in charge of it all wasn't really doing his best to make it work. You know, that would grind my fucking gears, and that reflects my own privilege that I can even relate to the idea of being at the resort and not getting what my entitled ass asked for.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
That's the part of it that's endearing for me, is that I relate to the narcissistic bullshit of it, right? Like that piece of us all in privileged America that just sort of goes around like everything's about us.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's the piece of Shane that's makes you want to punch yourself in the face, because you see it in you a little. Even not obviously varying degrees for all of us.
Of course,
and I'm not saying that there's a lot of that in me, but there was definitely a piece of me that was like, I'm shitty like that.
His treatment of Rachel as kind of a piece of arm candy was the more egregious sin in my own personal eyes, right? And I understand, I'm saying that from like a, not that that's objectively what was the worst thing about him, but for me it's like that's what got to me more, is the fact that he basically had no idea what this girl wanted at all. He just likes that she's hot.
Yeah, I don't know what objectively would have been worse about him, honestly. Like he was just kind of a douchebag that treated his wife like shit, and then she chose to stick around, and it's like but Quinn was the shocker for me, him staying. What did that say to you? What did that mean? And it's the piece of it that I'm like, yeah, okay, the Mossbachers just let their fucking minor child stay behind on an island, and he's going to do canoeing every day for the rest of his life.
They probably didn't, right? Like, they didn't really show us the finale, the conclusion of that. They just show that he was the one that...
Maybe he gets to stay a week longer. Maybe they had that conversation.
Yeah, or Mark and Nicole are coming off the plane right after his ass 10 seconds later, and we just don't see it because we fade to black. But, like... I forgive me, this might not be an original take, but like we talked about the whole escapism of the vacation thing, that was a piece of this as well, that everybody goes kind of looking for something or to reset or to disconnect or to find themselves or to have some transformative experience or to do, you know, no matter where we go, but especially on these like bigger, longer vacations to more exotic locations, I think we all carry a little bit of that with us, right?
Right.
Something about this is going to be great for me personally.
Yeah.
And he was the only one, I think, in the end that kind of like...
Found something
about himself that he didn't really know or understand before.
That was real, too.
That search for something that felt, you know, like he belonged, right?
Just go with his family and do whatever they were doing and be just like them. And like, you know, I mean, he was the only one for all of whatever Paula's friend's name is. What the hell's
Olivia?
Quinn's
Paula?
Sister? Olivia? For all of Olivia's like fake activism or whatever.
Right.
She doesn't really change. She
just goes back to mommy.
When it's all said and done.
Yeah.
Which is... definitely something I can identify with.
And it's also okay. Like, I think that was, again,
not
like
personally,
the whole, mind. Like, when Paula says to Olivia, right, like, that's, like, those are your people, that's your tribe.
Mm-hmm.
There's like, there's a lot, there is a lot of truth to that. Like, people do stick with their family. They do stick with the people that they've known their whole lives.
When it's beneficial, for sure. Absolutely.
And there's this, and I like, you know, part of the conversation over the last 2 years has maybe made you feel like bad about that. But I don't think that that's the bad piece of it. Right.
You mean what, for white people?
Yeah. But for anybody, because that same thing goes for everybody of all creeds and races, and any type of groups.
The part about
religion,
privilege.
The part that no matter how you identify, whether it's through your religion or through your race or through your hobbies or through your family or through your college or through your network or through your business, like the things that you identify with the most is where you go back to feel comfortable and belonged and wanted and whole.
Like you said, the tribe thing, your tribe.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so like Olivia seeking, you know, compassion and empathy from her mom at the end, like when it all comes down to it, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
It's just a reflection of like, of the divisions that make fixing the whole thing so difficult
and complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the piece of the show that I thought probably in the end, and you put it very poignantly, was most important. It was because it shows you it's not just like there are obvious things about all of our society that need fixing. And then there are the intricate levels and layers to it that are, like we said, complicated.
Yeah.
And that require a bit of dissection to really understand on a deeper level. You know, this was, I guess, like the HBO version of that conversation, right? It was definitely geared toward the already existing audience, I think, like the core HBO audience probably, but it was still a cool conversation to have, and in the end, a fun show. So like this is one where I definitely felt the momentum pick up, and as you put off mic, it kind of became like the show of the summer almost, maybe for lack of competition in some ways.
I mean, hey, yeah.
But in the end, it was a highly satisfying little journey. And I saw they got signed on for season 2.
They did. Yep.
I'm very interested to see what they do with that and all new characters, apparently.
All new cast and new location. I ran into a friend who used to work at Howler, who lives in California now and is kind of involved in kind of attempting to break into the industry a little bit. And she gave me a tip that season 2 is, and maybe it's not a tip, maybe it's like already on the trades, but it sounds like season 2 will be Europe somewhere.
Oh, yep. That will be fun.
Yeah.
So we got.
But it'll
that
be another
to.
Like quote unquote White Lotus resort.
Yeah.
And we'll have. You know. I think the.
Welcome to White Lotus, Tex and KK's. Armand is gone though.
Armand is.
Which is sad.
He did.
Yeah.
He got got.
Hopefully
we
have another
podcast.
Fun full blown degenerate.
I'm sure we will.
In season 2, but yeah, so it ended up being like I'll say, I'm gonna be harsh.
Yeah.
Okay, because I think it got a little bit of overloved on social media and such, just like I said, for lack of competition.
You're a fan of the underdog.
Yeah.
Ross, you tried to write off Mare of Easttown. Never forget. People.
That's true. It's not wrong. but so 7.2 for me after a
7.2.
Okay. After a few weeks.
That's a C minus.
And as a harsh critic, this is still in the watch it zone for me. Anything below C minus, don't watch it. Okay, C plus. That's not fair. B minus. Up to B minus. I'm going up to B minus. That's my final score.
Okay.
8.2.
All right. I'm going to give this, I'm giving this an 8.9.
Wow.
Out of 10.
That is bizarre.
I thought that the show was excellent, gripping, really, really fun. It was a perfect summer watch. The fact that they combined like real society and class conversation with the little bit of the whodunit kind of simmering underneath throughout was phenomenal. I thought all the performances were awesome. I, you know, obviously like everybody, I could sit here and name the performances, but then I just named the whole cast because everybody was so good. It does get that little extra bump for me because regardless of what it was competing or not competing against, the fact that it did kind of pick up all of the conversation, all of the TV conversation for the summer, I thought was really fun. And anytime you know, I go to something, I go to a happy hour, I go to, I see some friends, like, and like, I sat down at work, at a work meeting this morning, and somebody was like, so did you guys watch White Lotus? Like, the fact that it's a conversation point actually lifts it for me. It bumps it for me.
I feel you.
Because, you know, like, something that, you know, another show that I watched on Apple TV Plus called Physical, which I mentioned a little bit a few weeks back. Like, I loved that show. I thought it was phenomenal, but nobody wants to talk about it. Like,
right.
I don't think I know anybody else that has seen it except for maybe one other friend.
Yeah, some shows like, just gear themselves toward discussion more naturally than others. It's kind of weird, honestly. Sometimes it's not what I would expect. Sometimes there is a show I love that I'm like, yeah, we can't really talk about this on the podcast. Just because there's not much to say about it. It's more of like you get that all when you consume it. I lower my score for this one mostly because I think if you're under 30 years old, you're probably bored out of your mind.
I mean, there are plenty of people who that's a piece of the conversation I've seen. It's like both on Twitter and in person, people are like, I don't know what I'm watching. Which and just to add to that, I also saw like some pretty insightful tweets, I thought, that were basically poking fun at how a lot of the fans of White Lotus were the people that the show was kind of making the most fun of.
And saying like that they suck.
Yes, they kind of suck.
Which is what we're both copping to, sort of, in a way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I appreciate shows that can needle us, and I mean, I think the show is going after a little bit wealthier target than you and I personally, but we certainly relate we've been around those people, we know those people,
grew up around these people,
and so like, yeah, I mean, when a show can do that, I think when it can make you kind of look at yourself in the mirror a little bit and kind of ask yourself those questions, that's always fun and that's always good and that's always like healthy, right?
Yeah,
like so. It's
self-analysis is a big part of life.
So I did, so for me, it just kind of hit all the right notes.
Yeah, this was a fun one, man. It was one that honestly went into with knowing very little about what was going to happen, what kind of show it was going to be, or what it was going to try to say. That after the first episode, two episodes, I was like, I don't really know what's fucking. This is I can't tell. And by the time it's all said and done, very fun story. Great summer watch.
Plus, we got some, don't forget the eating butt. The eating of the butt.
And some ass eating.
Yeah.
And some classic TV characters here. and a good, great cast is what I mean. Like, great cast. I loved Tanya as an example. Stifler's mom being in there is huge. Armand was perfectly cast. Yes. I thought the Mossbachers were perfectly cast.
Steve Zahn, out of nowhere, right?
Hey, this guy, and I think we will see him appear in more HBO stuff as a result, because we know how that works.
Yeah.
So that was The White Lotus, and you're welcome that we waited 3 weeks so that the conversation could be as meaningful as it was. You're welcome.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Speaking of shows and conversation, if you would like to watch The Sopranos with Barrett and I, we are watching HBO's classic crime drama on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. For several months now, Barrett and I have been watching one episode per week every Wednesday night. We sit down in our respective households and take on an episode of The Sopranos. Barrett has never seen the show before. I've seen it several times through. And then the next day, Thursday, we record a podcast that is friendly to both first-timers and repeat watchers, spoiler-free, and full of discussion about just that episode and what has occurred in the season we are watching so far and in the show that we have seen so far. So, we are just finished with season 3 last week, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Barrett. And last week. Season 3 is done.
That is correct.
Which means if you sign up on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles today, Barrett, you could watch and enjoy a companion podcast for every single episode in the first 3 seasons of The Sopranos.
That's 39 episodes.
Immediately.
Big boy.
Immediately. So.
And girl. Big boys and big girls.
For everybody who wants to be motivated even further. The big caveat here is you're supporting the podcast. You guys are literally what keeps us in business. So everybody on Patreon already, we appreciate you. Thank you for your support and for bringing us this episode today. Today's episode is brought to you by everybody on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. And for those of you who aren't, get in there, support the show, and enjoy one of the greatest television shows of all time with two of your favorite podcasters of all time, Barrett and I, on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles today. Get in there. And enjoy. Season 4 on deck for those of you who are already there.
By the way, season 4, Season 5, they both have 13 episodes as well. I don't know why I thought that eventually The Sopranos turned into a 10 episodes per season show. It does not. Season 6 is very, very long. It's a two-parter. I don't know why they didn't just call this Season 6 and Season 7, because they're both almost the length of full seasons.
There was like a... We'll get to it on the pod.
Yeah, but there's a lot left.
Yeah,
Russ.
Yeah, oh yeah.
We're about halfway through.
We're getting to the meat. We have just hit season three, as Barrett and I discussed a lot on Patreon. Was the first like breakout season for The Sopranos. Really huge like breakout season in terms of critical success. I'm as a repeat watcher, very much looking forward to enjoying season 4, 5, and 6 with the rest of the Clam fam. So join us on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles now. Barrett, huge news.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere, no plan. Mm-hmm. I finally dove in to Ted Lasso.
You just fired it up.
Fucking head first, dude.
Yeah.
And I finished season 1.
You blew through it.
It's gone. I ate it.
Have you started season 2?
Not yet.
Okay.
I wanted to give myself a little time.
Okay.
I got a little lassoed out. I won't lie. That's a lot of Ted to take down and a lot of positivity, especially for a pessimist like me.
Uh-huh.
So, but no, I did want to talk a little about Ted Lasso season 1 today, because I know you loved it so much. We talked a lot about it when you watched it, as much as we could anyway.
Mm-hmm.
My mom loved it so much. So many people loved it, but a couple of people very close to me. And I finally got to get in there, and y'all were all right. Everybody who hollered at me on social media as well, y'all were all correct. This was like The Office mixed with sports, like it, in a more lovable Michael Scott instead of so like, you know, awkward.
Yes.
Ted Lasso ends up being even more than you think it will be on face value after a few episodes when they start to get into some of the heavier stuff. Ted's divorce, the panic attack he has, which... That episode wasn't fun. And I think I remember you being like, yeah, I watched an episode of Ted Lasso last night. That you, yeah, like, it's a good thing you're not watching this show.
Oh,
yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I watched it over the weekend, it fucked me up for a couple hours. I won't lie. I was just like, oh, God damn it. Even Ted Lasso has been poisoned. Every show has to have a main character have a panic attack now. And I'm just like, give us a break.
Yeah.
These are happening in real life for all of us. We don't necessarily need all of our characters on TV to have them. But it was deep. It had a message. It had all these different characters learning different lessons. Of course, it was a very optimistic look at the world where everybody sort of gets what they need to get message wise, right? Like what nobody this season, season one, didn't grow or learn something incredibly valuable.
Yeah. That's what was so surprising about Ted Lasso and like we talked about a little bit, last year. It's why it was so kind of like mind-blowing in a way, because we have, you know, and I remember talking a little bit about how like I kept expecting characters to be bad people or something, you know, some dark twist to occur, like, oh, this person's going to come in, they're going to ruin everything.
Right.
We're going to have this whole, you know, oh, this wasn't what it seemed. This person has an ulterior motive, like, you know, Ted gets screwed in this way or that way. Or
right.
Once
Roy got with Keeley,
uh-huh.
I was like, oh, well, clearly Jamie's going to come in and blow the whole thing up and they're all going to kill each other or whatever.
Yep. No. So the fact that it did like ride out that positivity is was very, very different and made the show like both genuine and heartfelt and heartwarming, but also unique, because no other show has really... You know, kind of they're zagging when everybody else is zigging.
Well, and that's what makes it comparable for me to The Office, to the likes of Parks and Rec.
Yeah.
Is that there's it while it will tackle heavier subjects from time to time with some comedic nuance, they never go full dark side. It's always warmth and growth and positivity when it's all said and done. And what Ted Lasso was, the thing that surprised me is they took kind of a classic sports trope, the major league thing, the owner that actually wants the team to fail.
Yep, yep.
And they flip it a little bit. They added just a little left turn there where she ends up making the right choice and being supportive in the end. And we're going to see what happens with season 2. I haven't started it yet. I know a lot of y'all have. And I've seen a lot of complaints.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to getting into
it. Which I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
Because as you gear up here for season two, and by the way, I watched the first, I can't remember if this Friday was the fifth or the fourth episode of season two. I think it was the fifth.
Let me check.
So I have not watched that one yet. So I believe I've watched four of the season two episodes. And I watched all four of those without realizing that there was a Ted Lasso backlash and critical slander about season two of the show.
Yep.
I dove in this at the end of last week, okay. And I've read up on the criticism.
Okay.
And it's interesting criticism. I'm very torn because it feels unfair in a way, because like, you know, finally a show is like making people happy and like showing a brighter side of life instead of everything being so dark and unfixable and intolerant and
ominous,
like, and ominous, yeah. and daunting and just in general awful. Like the point of most shows that we walk and talk about that we watch and talk about is that society kind of sucks and we're all fucked.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
I mean, a heavy amount of them. Yeah.
We can pick a show and kind of boil it down to that. And like,
I mean, I think that applies to like great American novels and like great novels, yeah, period.
Pick out a few strands of hope from each of these things, but like, Ted Lasso
is
only focused on finding the strands of goodness hope. And hope.
Yeah.
And so it feels a little unfair that we finally have a show like that's doing that and like making people feel good. And now we're like, wait, does this show suck?
You know what's funny, dude? I have people who are hitting me because I tweeted a little like, man, I finished Ted Lasso season one. It was really dope, blah, blah, blah. And people who are like, yeah, I think they're going to take it like on a really dark turn and suddenly it's going to get super real. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if they're gonna make that move, brother. It's kind of like once you found the formula, I don't think you stray from that.
I can do this without spoilers. Do you mind if I kind of break down one of the main criticisms of season two of the show?
Go for it.
So, do you remember how when I first talked about Ted Lasso, and you can tell me about your experience as well? Now, that first episode, did you like Ted Lasso?
Not yet, no. As a person coach, no.
A person coach and a character, did you think?
No, because the depth isn't there yet. You're annoyed by his positivity. You're kind of off-put by, like, what's this guy's deal?
By his weird Kentucky thing that he's doing.
The mustache, the style, yeah.
All the words that he's saying. You're just like, what, like,
what the hell is this? Yeah.
And, I mean, you could even describe it as corny, right?
He is. He's a corny dude.
So,
especially episode one.
Halfway through season one, about, or even really two or three episodes in, I think that we as viewers all found ourselves being like, oh, okay, like, I get it. Like, I can't help but like this guy. And that was literally the point of season one, is that despite how corny he is, how full of dad jokes and bad metaphors he is, how annoying his positivity can be, how, like, grating the persistent optimism can be. Like, you want to shake the dude and be like, don't you ever, like, approach anything with any type of reality or, like, pessim... You know what I mean?
Yeah, a little edge.
It's like Tony Soprano wanting to punch the happy... What is it called? The
happy wanderer.
The happy wanderers, right? He's a happy wanderer, and we kind of want to punch him in the face.
Yes.
And that's
well
the
done.
Point. That's the point, is that everybody... is that he does that to the viewers, but he also does that to everybody around him.
Mm-hmm.
He melts... the owner of the team, who's Rachel. Like he warms the heart of like even the surliest Roy Kents. He finds a way to connect with guys like Jamie Tartt. Rebecca, yes, not Rachel. We're crossing wires with White Lotus here. Rebecca, thank you. So that is the kind of the main conflict of season one, is that this dude is kind of a cheeseball. He's kind of annoying. And yet he convinces and warms the hearts of both all of us, the viewers, and everybody that he's working with in season one, around the team and the players and their personal relationships that he has and all of that.
Which the cool part of it for sports heads is that's what being a coach is. You have to get everybody to buy into you, your system, and your beliefs. So like, it also had this other layer where there was a lot of conversation about sports and a lot about team.
Yeah.
Manship, sportsmanship, whatever, and that was cool too, and in a realistic way. And then they did a limited amount of on the field dumb shit. It wasn't too much watching soccer, fake soccer. I don't want to watch fake soccer. Nobody really wants to watch fake soccer all that much. I think there's more fake soccer in season two, which is the only criticism I had seen up to this point. But I'm also not looking because I'm trying to not see season two takes for the most part.
So as we get into season two, we now all like Ted Lasso, including everybody on the show.
Sure. So what's the challenge?
So what's the challenge?
Yeah.
And now we go into the season two, and we're just from the jump, we're like supposed to find Ted endearing, and everybody likes him. And now his metaphors and cheesy dad jokes are like kind of supposed to be funny from the get-go.
Everybody's into it now.
Yes. And so there's this lack of like any type of struggle. Like,
where's
now
the
we're
conflict?
Just, yes. Now everybody is just good and warm-hearted and
on the same
and on
team
this,
and
yes,
page and yeah.
Yes. And there's an additional layer to this where they've kind of like seemingly maybe had an opportunity to do some interesting things and like create some conflict, and they've seemingly avoided them.
Oh.
In favor of continuing to just push the optimism and the happy-go-luckiness.
The good times vibes? So
I think that is why people are speculating that there might be some type of dark turn here, because the first half
seems like
of the
too
season,
much good stuff.
It seems like too much good stuff. Yes. And
I mean,
so
look.
It is an interesting critique. Yeah. And it does ask the question of like, where does this show go after season one? After you've already convinced us to like Ted Lasso, now what is there left to do, essentially?
Yeah. And I mean, that makes sense. It's like, I saw, and that's why I think there's calls for violence. There's calls for blood. People want to see something dark happen. People want to see
somebody upset. Something
go horribly wrong. And I think what they gave us in season one with that panic attack divorce episode was enough to convince us as viewers that they do know there's darkness to play with. So it's like, if there's an overwhelming amount of positivity the first four episodes of season two, then people are going to start to suspect that something is coming.
Yeah.
And I totally understand that. It's just hard for me to believe they would abandon the feel-good journey, because that's,
for me,
that's a huge part of this, dude. I need a show like The Office, like Parks and Rec, like that I can put on, know is going to have a fucking decently smart message, some clever jokes, get some laughs, and just make me feel good. That's a needed fucking category on television that comes and goes in terms of being filled for all of us with different shows like The Office and Seinfeld and et cetera, Arrested Development and all the great comedies. And some of the ones that fit into this direct category, though, are like Parks and Rec.
Parks and Rec, definitely. And I'll throw out there that while I was spending the last 3 weeks watching all of TV, I fired up Scrubs, some old Scrubs episodes.
There's another one?
That's Bill Lawrence's kind of original claim to fame, the creator and head writer of Ted Lasso.
Okay.
He was the showrunner and creator of Scrubs.
I did not know that.
Which tracks a lot when
it
you
does.
Think about it.
Yes, it does.
JD and Turk and Dr. Cox, like, that was also the point of that show, is that, like, even, you know, Roy Kent is essentially the exact same character as Dr. Cox was on Scrubs.
Sure.
The, like, the gruff guy.
But he loves you, but
that, like, is very, very, you know, abrasive and always frowning, but, like, at the end of the day, has a heart of pure gold.
Secretly has a...
Secretly, yeah.
Huge heart.
Exactly. Yeah. So the...
And it's about the friendships in that spark between the characters, just like on Scrubs, where it's like the interactions between Rebecca and Higgins and Ted and Nathan, the assistant guy that ends up becoming a coach. And it's just very well done, character building wise, to where you just end up rooting for a bunch of different people, and then they keep getting what they need to get, and it's like hitting the fucking slot machine over and over, dude. It gives you those little endorphins, like, all right, yes, yes, good.
So it's never really going to abandon that. Even if it does, you know, start to find some darker places or explore some darker themes, or have these people go through, you know, some more significant trials and tribulations, like, this show is all about heart. And so it's always going to come down to that. Like, it's always going to be, I think, a show that leads with the positivity and the optimism.
And I hope you're right. I hope they never abandon what I would call, like, the secret sauce for shows like this. And man, Sudeikis is very close to the top of, like, my favorite people in Hollywood at this point.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Especially because I think he was able to drag some of his real life pain and suffering into this character.
Absolutely.
And through with his own divorce and everything that went down with him in his personal life. And it's like, that's the shit that is missing for me most of the time with what I would call A-listers. And I would consider Sudeikis to be an A-lister at this point.
I think he is now, yeah.
And most of the time, the most biggest celebrities in our country are, like, inaccessible. and you don't really know anything about them, and you don't feel like they're anything like you or that they could possibly be fun to hang out. Like Leo, as an example.
Yeah.
I just don't feel like he would give a shit about my jokes. You know what I mean? Like, this guy couldn't possibly care what I have to say.
There's no way that you could hang out with Leo right
now and have a good time.
Because
it would be intimidating. I'd be too worried about, like, not being cool in front of him.
Totally.
Or, like, which 23-year-old model was about to fall on my head off his third story of his yacht.
Yes.
Sudeikis, I'm like, I could sit down with this dude and be best friends in 2 minutes.
Right, right.
And that's rare. It's a rare quality in Hollywood. And I feel like even in the social media age where everybody's trying to be Mr. Likeable and fucking have a podcast and be an activist, and it's like,
yeah,
I don't buy most of it. With him, even as I lose my voice in the middle of the show, I believe it. And I like it. And I like seeing him win. So this one was clearly one of the bigger wins on TV in 2020.
Yep.
And that's when it dropped, right?
Yes.
And we'll see how they do with the rest of season two. Hopefully I'll be caught up with you guys in the next couple weeks.
I bet you will be. Because
girlfriend's already begging me to start season two last night. And I was like, if I have to watch any more of Ted right now, I'll go crazy. he's just too positive, and being in a situation where I relate to him, it's even more frustrating because I am the opposite.
And I also just want to say that, like, you know, I feel like recently I've been maybe getting soft about the criticisms of shows.
You feel soft lately?
Yeah, because, you know, everybody knows now that, like, I don't really care about finales anymore, and, like, I'm not holding these, like, giant expectations for shows.
I think that's just wisdom, Barrett.
And for a show like Ted Lasso that I think found success somewhat unexpectedly, certainly the level of success that show found was unexpected.
Yeah, we didn't see it coming.
Right, but leading into season two, suddenly everybody's favorite show, at least their favorite 30-minute show.
It's a lot to live up to.
It's a lot to live up to. A lot of shows have a bit of a sophomore slump when they're trying to figure out, oh, well, fuck, we're a household name that everybody's watching now. We got to figure out how to make this work again.
Keep it going.
Like, don't forget that, like, a show like Succession, shouts to Succession, we have a coming back
soon.
In October now.
Very excited.
But, like, it was still just a critical and podcast darling after season one. You know, we were all jazzed about season two, but, like, its real test, its Ted Lasso test, is this season three coming up.
Sure.
Because now it's everybody's favorite show, which, by the way, I'm having a hard time pushing down the whole, like, I liked this band first thing, you know, now they've sold out and everybody loves them and I kind of fucking hate them for that.
Yep.
I'm having a very hard time because...
What is that about us?
Because people are... It's human nature. Because
it's our thing, and then once everybody wants in, and we all know what happens in the end.
That's
kind of what it feels like, right? It's like we all know what happens in the end once everybody's in. Like Thrones, right?
Also, everybody just wants... When you find something first that's great...
Yeah.
It's this weird... It's just
special
a weird thing because you simultaneously are, like, happy for it because... Now there's more people to talk about it with, and everybody found, you know, yes. You're like, come get this. But at the same time, you're like, it's like the one in credit thing. You're like, well, we knew about it. We were on it first. You know.
You fucking idiot. Like my dipshit friend who doesn't even watch TV texts me like, oh, man, Succession season three is about to start because he knows I have a TV podcast. And I'm like, you don't know dick about Succession, dude. You don't love it the way I do, that Barrett does. You don't know us, the Clam fam.
But season three of Succession will be kind of the Ted Lasso test. I'm just saying, like, once you're, you know, once you hit that level, I'm excited to watch season four of Sopranos for this reason as well, right? Because this is we're going into the season where, like, now they're the Sopranos.
And the expectation is there.
So it's always interesting to watch how a show reacts and tackles kind of the knowledge that they are a certified, bona fide
winner.
Hit. Yeah.
Can I say that I think the only way to beat that is to ignore it entirely?
Yeah, I mean,
I think it's the only way to beat that level of success is to act like it is not happening at all.
Right.
And y'all are just fucking around doing an indie.
Yep.
That's the only way. Otherwise, you lose that shine. So, even having the amount of buildup that I did for this show, I was still surprised with how good it was. Like, I was still surprised with the quality of the show. And especially, just, I haven't really been on board for stuff like this. Anything emotional, heartfelt, like, I'm just like, oh, fuck me. Come on.
Yeah, you love dark stuff. Everybody knows that about you.
Yeah, so this has been this is not something that typically I'm all in for. Like Parks and Rec even used to be a sort of like, I had to pick my spots.
Yeah, right.
Because it was just like so, everybody's fun and happy and wins in the end.
Parks and Rec and Scrubs, I think, are the two closest comps as far as like the feeling that this show evokes of like everybody likes each other.
Right.
And like they're all supportive and hoping it all works out for the best, everybody for each other.
Yes.
You know, and even the Office and especially something like Arrested Development has like a lot of
inner fighting and
acidity
shit.
To it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like sarcasm where people are
all messed up. Yeah.
So,
but these people, not them, boy. No, they're having perfectly peaceable love triangles where they sit at tables and talk to each other like it's all good, baby.
Yeah.
I wish this is the world we lived in, the world that Ted lives in, but alas, it is not. Any other stuff you watched that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, let me throw some other
about.
Stuff out at you here before we say goodbye.
Hit us.
I did finish Dave season two. I've told you about this. The run of the back half of Dave season two is inarguably very, very, very good TV.
Okay, so
especially episodes 9 and 10. Russ, I don't remember the last time that I ran back an episode immediately after watching it and then like watched the ending like a few times.
You ran back a Dave episode?
Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't run back an episode in many years, Barrett.
Episode 10 makes you run it back. Like it wants you to run it back. And at the very least you run back the last 10 minutes of the episode because it just does that to you and it's and you get a euphoric high at the end of it. Episode 9, as I told you a little bit about, is like very much like a kind of, you know, it's a cliche of television for a character to go on a bit of a trippy, potentially drug-induced kind of vision quest in their own mind where they're like having all these weird
spiritual journey
things happen and they're learning about themselves and what makes them tick and what they need to do to kind of
level up.
Yeah, and finish out their journey and accomplish their goals. And that happens in episode 9 of Dave in a phenomenal way that like works on every level and is also brilliant. And then the few episodes before that, just like this is, it's what, just to spin this into a bit of a larger conversation about TV, we know that Netflix drops everything all at once pretty much now.
Right.
They are the binge watching model.
Right.
And we know that HBO drops week by week.
Right.
They are the week by week model. And then there've been some other stuff like The Boys on Amazon that like will drop the first three and then they do it week by week.
After that.
I think Hulu is doing that as with some shows as well. But this release schedule almost needs to be factored in to each and every show as an individual piece of its puzzle now. You know what I mean?
And because, how it's rated, right?
Yeah, because some shows, something like Mayor of Easttown, for example, demands that it be released week by week.
That's not a binger.
You don't want to binge it. And the fact that it leaves you hanging every episode builds the hype and the anticipation.
And is the fun of it.
And is the fun and creates that love of the show. Something like Dave would have benefited so profoundly from being all available because this season is one whole. You know, I hate the phrase because it gets tossed around so much, but it's a 10-hour movie. You know what I mean? And like, you need all those episodes that were so weird at the beginning of season two.
Right.
Make so much sense once you've seen the conclusion of season two.
And I mean, that's also an audience problem. Like, we as bingers and stream watchers at this point, we're all constantly judging the project before it's done, right? Which is like, I mean, it's part of the podcast here. Like, we discuss the episodes as they're coming out, and then we discuss the season as a whole once it's all the way done, like we are right now. But we all want to react immediately for social media, for Twitter in particular. And that leads to a lot of negativity when it's not necessarily needed yet. And for me, it wasn't about Dave's first few episodes being so weird that I had to abandon ship so much as that I could tell where we were at and where we were going. And I was like, I can't do this right now. Like, I just had too much weird shit going on in my personal life. Now I'm in a better place. And honestly, it was fucking awesome watching the last month of my life. Every day I had at least a few people in my mentions like, bro, I am begging you. I will come to your house and massage your feet while you watch the rest of Dave's season two.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. They closed it out so well, blah, blah, blah. Everything you just said, basically. And I was so happy because I was worried, like, with all the negativity and me not being able to handle it right now, and like we kind of just left it alone for a little bit. I was worried that it maybe wouldn't work out, and for him to have like just proven the concept even in a season where he had Benny Blanco's asshole filled with gum,
bubble gum,
and they're calling each other Chuck, is so fucking Dave, and it's just it's what made the first season great, and I'm so glad they pulled off season two. I'm excited to watch it.
One more selling point for you, Ross. There's an episode, I can't remember which one it is. It's either 7 or 8. It tosses back. It goes half flashback to when Dave was had a regular day job and thinking of, and he was thinking about being a rapper.
Oh shit!
And I very much believe that. I mean, I don't have to believe he's said as much. A lot of this shit is pulled from real life. It's inspired by what he was actually going through.
Right.
So he's at this day job, and the album that is currently inspiring him to like truly like start making that leap and make the jump and go all out is Yeezus. And you know the meme out there that's like, tell me you're a ba 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 without telling me you're a sum.
Yeah.
It's like, tell me you're a 35-year-old white guy without telling me you're a 35-year-old white guy. And it's like, we're all fucking inspired by Kanye West in some way, shape, or form. He didn't lie when he said he was the voice of this generation. At least he didn't lie when it came to suburban white dudes.
And Barrett, you know what I mean? You're not wrong again. Where I mentioned this a second ago. I said I had a boy text me out of nowhere about Dave season two, and that in and of itself. Was that what I was talking about?
Succession.
Thank you. Yeah. I was like, I don't think it was Dave season two. About Succession, and that let me know like it's in the mainstream, but that it's also incredibly influential. Like I had another same situation with the Kanye album.
Yeah.
And it's like, for all the hate, for all the criticism, for all the, oh, he's just an egotistical narcissist, or like for people who completely miss the mental health side of it, or the personal struggle side of it that he has, or his mother's stuff, or the Kim stuff, or people that think he's just a big joke or whatever. And it's like, there's inarguably a level of influence there, even with those people.
Yeah.
And nobody else in the world in my lifetime has had that kind of power to get everyone to talk about them, no matter what it was they were doing, no matter how ridiculous. And as he's put it himself, like, he is a paradigm pusher. He shifts what the rest of the fucking industry is doing and focused on. And to pretend otherwise is stupid as fuck. Like, to pretend that he's not the most influential musician is, to me, crazy and indicative of some other issue within yourself.
Yeah, and you know, I'll sit here and I could sit here and be a fill-in for Shitta, who's coming on your podcast tomorrow.
Oh, he absolutely destroyed me and
to argue
and Donna.
Because there are a lot of things going on with the Kanye situation right now, which, like, I want to fucking Harry Carey because I hate myself for paying attention to it so much.
I know.
You know what I mean? Like, this dude is bringing up fucking Marilyn Manson on the stage, and I got to hear this shit and listen.
Can I please explain that one real quick?
And we got to, and fucking 16-year-old kids all across the nation are like, oh, I guess Marilyn Manson's okay now.
Yeah.
He's really pushing the envelope. You wouldn't get it.
See, but that, okay, so let me step in and explain this one, though.
Like, and now we get to put all those words in all these little white kids' mouths.
But that's the thing about this guy that makes him, it's like, he's kind of a moron sometimes. Like, he doesn't see the difference between himself, Marilyn Manson, DaBaby, and Donald Trump is the other person he invited to be a part of that stage in that moment, who apparently declined. Don't know
That's
why.
Shocking.
Wow. Thought he would have totally participated in that with a 15-plus timed accused sexual assault person in Manson, and then an ignorant homophobe.
Even Donald Trump didn't want to share the stage with Marilyn Manson?
Yes, I do. And... What I mean is, like, if you're looking for an explanation about why Kanye does stuff like that, it's because he has absolutely no idea what he's doing. he's not well all of the time.
Yeah.
Like, that's a big piece of this that people seem to write off very easily. This man is bipolar. He is more enabled than any other artist in the world by money and power and fame at this point, and clearly is not surrounded by anybody. Everybody always says, like, oh, he's surrounded by yes men. I don't think that's it. I think it's that it doesn't matter who he's surrounded by.
Yeah.
He doesn't listen to anybody he doesn't want to listen to.
Uh-uh.
So at this point, like, you're getting the pure artistic version of a crazy person's work. And I mean that with all due respect, because this is probably, to me, the most influential artist in my lifetime.
So that's a, and that's going to bring perfect closure to the rest of what I want to say. watching young Dave vibe out to Blood on the Leaves, and just like we all did, and like watching him have this same kind of experience and like feeling of like, oh my God, what is happening? What am I listening to? That I know we all had for several albums in a row there. And then watching him like use that inspiration and push it forward for his own art, close out this season in the way that he does, it's so fulfilling to watch somebody be like, you know,
the highest version of themselves
on the same, close to the same level of Kanye as far as like pushing artistic boundaries, and not be a fully like insane person,
right?
You know what I mean?
And I think that's totally fair.
That's a fair criticism. That was another reason that like that I loved the ending so much, is because you get that, because I of course related to the whole the Kanye thing that he shows in episode 7 or 8, and then like Dave is like a relatively normal dude, you know? I mean, he's an artist, so of course he's got his quirks. We see his quirks on the show. Very, very, you know.
Weird penis.
In full view.
Milking table.
Right? Like, this dude is not a normal guy either. But at the same time, the fact that he is like, and of course, and again, way too long of a conversation to have here when we're already an hour in. Like,
hard disagree.
Like the fame, you know, the fame and level of money that Kanye achieves, like, changes the calculus there. And nobody can say what they would do with that type of influence, money, and exposure, and constantly being watched and photographed, and the whole thing is like,
who can understand it? You just don't really know and understand.
But it is fun watching an artist like Dave, like Lil Dicky, pull that inspiration, make it his own, and put it out into this version that is like just really satisfying and really great. So highly recommend finishing season 2 for anybody that dropped off halfway.
I'm excited to watch it. I do understand that we have to end today's show, but now I'm thinking of ways that you and me could get another show to just talk about Donda for an hour, so more on that potentially later. But I did discuss it on the Ross Boland podcast on Monday. I gave some of my takes on it, and as I admitted on that pod, like, it's one that's geared very much, again, a project that's very much geared for me, like, as Shitto, our guest on tomorrow's episode of RBP, put it, it has divorced dad energy, and that I carry that with me now, and that's fine. I totally understand that, and like Barrett said, like, being a 35-year-old white dude who's inspired by Kanye is probably the least original
trait
you can have, and yet it is one of the bigger ones for me, which makes me hate myself sometimes. but like, and looking forward to the Drake album also, I'm just like, I hate myself. But, and when I get my Spotify year in review, I hate myself. It's just so basic.
Yep.
But I do believe.
I don't think a year has gone by where Kanye and Drake both are not in my top 5 since I've had Spotify.
It's sad. But it's also not sad because, dude, he is undeniably good at connecting all of us, whether it's through hate, criticism,
yeah,
or because we love the music, or some of the music, or we think some of the music's absolutely crazy, or his behavior's insane and inexplicable. He clearly tried too hard to find something to be controversial about so that he could promote
this. Right, right, yeah.
That's where Manson and the baby come in, okay? Outside of that, this was the most fun I've had. I loved the listening party shit. I loved the full version of it. If you didn't understand what he did, was he basically let us partake in the creation of the album. Everybody that got to watch, everybody that got to give feedback on social media ended up being a part of the end creation of the album, which is a pretty cool thing that I've never seen happen.
Did you buy yourself one of the little stem players?
I did. But I'm in content is my excuse. It had to be done. Did you?
No, because I don't know how to use it. But
well, neither do I, Barrett. I don't even know what it is.
But I'm glad that you bought one. I'd like to see it.
I knew that I had to be the one to take the hit for all of us, so I figure I get one. We'll see what it does. And look, he's again, as I discussed with Shitto, the contradictions of Kanye are never ending. The things he says versus does, very confusing.
Yeah,
and vice versa. But in the end, I do believe. If you can't look away, and if it's on the level that he's been able to produce and back up the dumb shit he says, like being the voice of a generation, at some point you got to put your hands up, take your hat off, and say, good for you, sir. You're quite good.
Last two things before we wrap up here. These will be short. I'm just going to give you a one thumbs up and one thumbs down. Which do you want to hear first?
Thumbs down first, please.
Thumbs down first. Okay. Nine Perfect Strangers on Hulu. I gave this I gave this four episodes, and to be perfectly honest, I have not decided whether I'm going to continue or not. This is another Nicole Kidman, like, puts on something weird and does an accent, and it's a miniseries. It's like a limited series. So it's one of those, you know, you have The Undoing, you got Big Little Lies, now you got Nine Perfect Strangers.
Nice.
There's been a lot of talk that this is about people at a resort, so it, like, unfortunately followed White Lotus too closely, probably.
Okay.
It's also just not as good. It's got a lot of, it's got a phenomenal cast that are, they're just all trying to do too much. The writing of the show is a little bit lacking. They're trying, they're doing the thing where they're like, based on the characters and the knowledge that all the characters have, we, the audience, should also have that knowledge, but they won't tell us.
Okay.
Even through four episodes. And
yeah.
I hate that type of storytelling. Like, you don't, we're almost halfway through the season, right? And, like, you got no fucking clue what Nicole Kidman is, this Russian Masha lady leading Quintilium or Tranquillum, the resort, is up to. We don't know what she, we don't know.
Yeah, so it's, okay, so I hate shows like that too.
Yeah.
Where they keep the whole premise from you almost.
Yes.
And then pretend that's somehow clever.
Yes. And right. And I'm not, like,
and we're like, hey, we don't know what we're watching every week.
Yes.
Could you guys help us out?
Yeah, give me something for through the first, not something, give me a lot after four episodes so that I know what the fuck is happening.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if I'm going to finish that. But if you've been thinking about it, you don't need to go there unless you just absolutely have nothing else to watch and you love Nicole Kidman doing weird Russian accents.
So Nine Perfect Strangers.
That's correct. My thumbs up, a docuseries on HBO, 100 Foot Wave.
Oh, I keep almost clicking on this.
If you've listened to this podcast, if you follow me on Instagram at Barrett Dudley, then you're also probably well aware that I am a well-known surfer.
Professional surfer.
I'm a borderline professional surfer.
Semi-professional.
Semi-professional. I love to get barreled, totally pitted. Just, you know.
So pitted.
Just so pitted and ride waves. And, like, it's so crazy when they, like, tumble you and you don't know which way is up. And, like.
Just taking in the cosmic energy of the sun.
Right. And I'm just out there. I'm paddling out. And I'm catching waves. And, like. You know, I'm hanging 10 and curling my toes and ripping it out there. That's,
all those things.
Right. All those things. It's what I do.
But
Ross.
Mostly getting pitted.
It's what I do.
Yes.
So.
And you rack up tens of thousands of Instagram likes with your footage of your incredible surfing.
So it's no surprise that I had to go in on 100 Foot Wave.
Of course.
Which just takes the whole thing to, like, levels that, again, you want to talk about things that you just can't understand and that are seemingly unknowable. These dudes are using jet skis, and I knew about tow-in surfing, but the way all of the physics work, I don't understand it. This is when you start surfing 30, 40, 50 foot waves, you can't catch that wave.
So you have to.
You can't paddle out and then paddle and catch the wave like you can.
Right. It doesn't work that way.
2 to 15 footers, basically.
Right.
Doesn't work that way. The only way is your surfboard, which is, like, almost looks more like a snowboarder at that point because it's so narrow, has little slots for your feet to hook under. You grab on to a tow on a jet ski, and that jet ski pulls you in almost like you're starting to wakeboard.
Oh my God.
And then you catch these waves. And this dude, Garrett McNamara, is, like, on the hunt. His mission in life, what he feels cosmically called to do, is to catch a 100 foot wave.
Okay.
And he got in 2011, I want to say, he got, and I have not seen the whole series. I'm two or three episodes in. In 2011, he caught a 78 foot wave.
Jesus Christ!
The footage is, like,
where was it?
About halfway through, like, the whole thing is that where they are, Garrett McNamara and his crew in search of this wave also kind of uncovered a surfing spot in Nazaré, Portugal.
Wow. Okay.
Where, like, this 4 mile trench in the ground leading up to these giant rock banks, like,
creates massive waves.
Anyway, you do not have to, like, Laura's enjoying this. She's not a surfer or surf interested.
Right.
It's a total human interest story. Like, it's
well, much like Free Solo. It's like, I'm not interested in rock climbing
but
fascinating.
What drives these people to, like,
seek that type of adventure?
Yeah, because it's so much more at this point, like, it's not just that they're thrill seekers. That is a part of it. They are chasing, like, a certain high. But when you start listening to them talk about, like...
It's like they're driven by this unknown thing.
This unknown force, mm-hmm. exactly. And you can't...
It's the same thing with the Free Solo guy, where you cannot explain why somebody would be drawn to this life.
Yeah. Yep.
This very specific, seemingly no payoff whatsoever for the ridiculousness of it life.
Yep.
And that's what makes those so fascinating to me. There's also always
Absolutely.
Like, it's a reminder that there's all these different types of people in the world that are driven by different things and different motivations and different... And some people, it's like simply that they're in such a, like their mind works in such a way that they have to have something like that to chase.
Yep.
And it's really interesting. So like, I'm very much looking forward to watching 100 Foot Wave. That one is on HBO, correct?
That is on HBO. It's 6 episodes, so it's not a huge endeavor. I know you like documentaries.
Yeah, man.
If you're out there looking for a docuseries and you like the human interest and you like people pursuing these passions or drives, if you like Free Solo or Last Dance or like any of these that are just about people kind of like
they're freaks
that are exploring their own limits and pushing a boundary that is almost unexplainable as to why they're pushing it
and almost unattainable
and all, then it's it should be pretty fascinating.
I'm stoked. Yeah. Very stoked, because that one, I'm telling you, I get my clicker over it, highlighted it or whatever, and I stare at that wave in the picture for a second, and then I'm like, maybe tomorrow, because that thing is fucking huge, man. And those dudes, unlike you, Barrett, being a semi-professional surfer, I have no experience with surfing at all, but I freaking love the ocean, like obsessed with it. So anyway, again, stoked for 100 Foot Wave. Holler at Barrett and I on social media, at Barrett Dudley everywhere, at WR Bolin on Twitter and Instagram, with your thoughts on whether it be the White Lotus, if you want to talk more, or get up on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles, join our Discord server and talk more with a bunch of other listeners in there. The cord is strong. Enjoy The Sopranos with us on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. And we'll be back on Thursday with an episode of season 4 right there on Patreon for y'all to enjoy. And back next week with whatever the hell Barrett and I decide to watch between now and then. I might get some 100 Foot Wave in, but obviously we've already discussed that, so I'll bring something else to the table, I promise.
Okay.
I promise.
Yeah,
appreciate y'all.
More Marvel? You watching any more Marvel?
I think I did watch another Marvel. What's after? Do you know the order off the top?
Nah.
Okay.
I know you watched Thor 2. Maybe Avengers Age of Ultron? You do that one yet?
Nope.
Okay.
So maybe that's what I have next. Right. But I'll get into those. Yeah, I'll get back into Marvel. The last few months of viewing stuff for me, loved it. This has been a good mix for me. Really enjoying it. Y'all have a great rest of your week, and Barrett and I will see you next week. Appreciate you. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends about the show and support us watching The Sopranos with us on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. Peace!